From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com. You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 1993, the comics industry began to enjoy a new respectability. Art Spiegelman's graphic novel Mouse had just won a Pulitzer. Tim Burton's Batman movie was a huge hit. And my next guest published a work of literary and art theory in comic book form called Understanding Comics. 13 years later, that book is being taught in universities and has made its author, Scott McCloud, arguably the world's premier comics theorist. Now he's written Making Comics, Storytelling Secrets of Comics, Manga, and Graphic Novels. It's published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to my show today. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Leonard.
When you wrote Understanding Comics in 1993, it followed just a number of lighthearted comics fiction. Did you expect it to be a new direction for you?
I didn't know what was going to happen with that book. All I knew was that I had all these ideas and I had to put them somewhere. And I think at the beginning I was only speaking to my fellow cartoonists, and I was surprised and happily surprised to find out that it went far beyond that.
Well, as a comic book artist, is it frustrating that you're famous for teaching people the theory and practice of comics fiction when, you know, you haven't had a hit in that area yourself?
That's right. Oh, it's very frustrating. Actually, I'm determined that my next project will be a graphic novel. And I've had the story in my head for about 20 years. It's probably going to go to 400 or 500 pages. I have to do some fiction because just talking about how it works is not enough. You have to at least give it a shot yourself.
But it's also brought you a different kind of audience. When did you realize that people outside the comic book reading community were reading that book?
Well, it came in stages. I think about 94, I started to get wind of people in the multimedia development community, interface design. Later, it was the people designing games. People in academia. It's
teaching it at Harvard.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The book just traveled because the whole notion of visual communication was, I guess, interesting on so many levels for people who had not necessarily any interest in comics. And then I was lucky that a general groundswell of interest in comics coincided with that.
Well, comics are taken more seriously. I don't think that... I remember the first time I spoke to Art Spiegelman, and he was already getting bored with people asking why did he do it as a comic book, Mouse, instead of as a regular book. People stop asking that question. I don't think Marianne Satrapi was asked that question for Persepolis. People understood by then.
Yeah, I think in fact, Persepolis may be that point at which that question, you're right, has vanished. I was recently up at Eastern Michigan University for 6-7 weeks, and I went to several classes where Persepolis was being taught in a number of different subjects, and almost nobody seemed impressed by the novelty of it as a comic. That was just the norm.
But do you and your colleagues, people like Chris Ware, Joe Sacco, or Chester Brown, like this newfound attention? Is there a longing to go back to a time when the New York Times Book Review wouldn't even consider critiquing it, or the New York Times Sunday Magazine wouldn't even think of publishing a strip as they do now?
Well, I think Comics Progressive Wing may be of two minds on that. I think some of us like the notion of comics getting that respectability, being hung in galleries or discussed in the New York Times Review of Books. And then there are others who like the notion of comics as this dark, under-the-radar bit of scrappy pop culture that somehow escapes a lot of the censorship.
When you say comics, are you thinking the same thing that most people are, that it's a catch-all that includes everything from family circus to what you do?
I am, although I think my definition probably extends a little beyond that to old broadsheets, some Egyptian wall paintings, digital comics, web comics, all that sort of thing. I think I probably have one of the broadest footprints in what I think of when I say the word comics.
So Daumier is a comic comic
artist?
Well,
if anything that tells a story in a sequence of images, something like, you know, the Hogarth's prints or something like the Bayeux Tapestry, I think is very similar art form.
Then there are people who like the idea of calling them graphic novels to distinguish serious works from comics. Others objected to that. No, I'm just a comics artist, even though I'm serious.
I think that was a stage we had to go through. Will Eisner, who had a lot to do with the evolution of comics in the 20th century, he popularized that notion of the graphic novel. And once that term had become ensconced in the popular mind, then we could go back to calling them comics.
And your new book is called Making Comics, not Making Graphic Novels.
That's right.
But do you... who do you think will be reading this? Is this aimed at aspiring comics creators? Are you trying to give people an insight into what you do?
Well, certainly that. I mean, obviously, I'm interested in catching, especially younger creators, those who are just discovering comics now, and there are a lot of people, especially young women who are reading Japanese comics. That's a huge chunk of those who are discovering the medium right now. But also, I hope that this book will be of interest to anyone who's interested in storytelling generally, the way that stories are structured, and just the whole business of communicating from human to human.
You mentioned Japanese comics and the appeal of manga, for example. Do you think that comics are comics no matter where, or do different cultures do different things with the form?
I think comics are comics no matter where, but it's fascinating to see how the form evolves. I think of Madagascar, you know, the notion of this island, a cultural island in which evolution is allowed to proceed in isolation from others. And that was true of certainly of Japan from about 1950 through 1975. There wasn't a lot of interaction between the cultures, and they evolved in very different ways.
But you still, and you talk about the ways different cultures react to comics and iconography. Can you give us an example of a visual signal that, say, a Japanese reader might understand but an American might not?
Japanese comics have some really oddball ones. When somebody's asleep, they'll have this huge bubble of mucus coming out of their nose, or when they're sexually aroused, blood will shoot out of their nose. A lot of nasal fixations for some reason. You know, we have the little X's for eyes when somebody's knocked out. Ours are pretty strange too, but we're used to them.
Is this something that appeals to everybody, or are there some cultures? I think of Japan, the United States, France, as being particularly comic book friendly, although in different ways. We like superheroes here, and I don't think superheroes are big in other cultures.
They aren't. And in fact, I think early on, when I was getting into the business, there was this notion that superheroes were somehow comics' manifest destiny, that it was just inevitable that a visual medium like this would naturally head towards the spectacular, sensationalist subject matter of that. But we would look at Japan and we'd look at what was going on in Europe and say, no, this is not comics' destiny. This is just where our culture took it.
And why do you think Americans love superheroes and we keep on coming up with more and more variations?
Well, we do seem to love the journey of the individual, the idea of the empowerment of the individual. But I think that cuts across all media. And comics hitchhiked on the back of that. But so do games. So do other forms of literature. So do some movies. It's not comics' only place. And I'm happy to say that recently, American cartoonists have gone in so many other directions that now superheroes are just part of the landscape.
Well, I just can't wait until I see Superman snorting a little bit of blood when he sees Lois Lane. Scott McCloud is my guest. He's the author of Understanding Comics, a classic now. And now, from Harper, Making Comics, Storytelling Secrets of Comics, Manga, and Graphic Novels. This book has some of the theories that you also had in Understanding Comics. I wonder if you could elaborate on some of them. For example, the idea of the gutter. Now, in advertising, I know what the gutter is, or magazines. The gutter is that space between the two pages.
And it's possible that the term in comics evolved from that, from the publishing industry. But I like to think of the gutter a little bit more metaphorically. It's that blink in between images where the audience is asked to imagine what happens, where we stitch two disparate static images together and make them move in our minds.
And then we provide the third image. In a way, this goes back to Greek tragedy, doesn't it? Oedipus pulls his eye out offstage.
Yes.
Or in movies, we can have a thing leading up to an important moment and then cut to the aftermath.
Right. You see examples of that in theater. You see examples of that in movies. But only in comics do you have that kind of call-and-response rhythm between the artist and the reader, where the artist gives the reader something to imagine in the panels, and then the reader comes back constantly. That call-and-response rhythm again and again and again is the actual substance of comics. It's what brings comics alive. So it's different from that sort of that continuous illusion that you find in movies with the persistence of vision, for example.
So you say that if in one frame a killer with an axe, there's a killer with an axe and a potential victim followed by a scream, the only person who actually killed the victim is the reader.
Yes, and in a thousand different ways.
You also have a theory about why simple images like smiley faces and cartoon sketches are so easy to relate to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is from direct observation and from intuition and inference, but it seems to me that our sense of our own faces when we're in social situations is a very generalized sort of sense, very sketchy, almost a little bit like a smiley face itself. And so these simpler faces that we see in, like, say, early Disney cartoons or in a lot of comics may give us a chance to step inside the character and identify with that character in a way that's different from that sense of the other that we get from highly rendered images.
Now, you distinguish between what comics do and what films do, although many people have pointed out that there are great similarities, and sometimes the influence has been from film to comics and sometimes from comics to films.
Oh, yeah.
And it's been a reason some people say that so many comics have been adapted into films, mm-hmm. Going all the way back to to very early movies. So can you study film theory and learn about comics, or do you really think that we should see major distinctions?
I think film can teach us a lot about comics. Comics can teach us a lot about film. There's been some debate over time as to whether the similarities were more interesting or if the differences were more interesting. At the very beginning, though, you just have this very simple idea of sequential images, and it's this tiny bit of gene splicing that leads to the differences between the two media. In the one case, you have images shown in the same space at different times, and in the other you have images shown at different spaces at the same time. And it's that tiny little difference that leads to a world of differences in the two cultures.
About 6 years ago, you wrote a book called Reinventing Comics, in which you suggested ways for the comics medium to change and grow, especially through the Internet. That book didn't take off the way the others have.
No, it was a lot gnarlier. It was a lot more dense. I describe reading that book as like eating 10 pounds of potato salad.
But do you think that your predictions have come true, any of them?
Oh, some of them, yes. Certainly not so much in the economic realm, because we're still, I think, floundering a little bit and people are finding other sorts of economic models online. But in terms of the flowering of genres online and this explosion of comics on the web, that's absolutely an ongoing revolution.
When you came in, I asked you where you're living these days, and you said nowhere, that you're making the book tour into your home. Can you explain that a bit?
Well, my wife always wanted to visit all 50 states, and when the book came out, and I had spent so much time at the drawing desk that my family hadn't seen enough of me. Now they're going to see plenty of me, because we're going to see all 50 states, 5 provinces in Canada, London and Barcelona, and we're just driving all over the place in this little minivan of ours, and we don't even know where we're going to live when we're done. We just put everything in storage.
I asked you about national differences. Are there state differences in the appeal of comics?
You know, I think we're starting to see that. I am starting to see regional differences. There's a sort of cheap tool, Sharpie bravado in the Bay Area. There's a sort of semi-mainstream feeling here in New York. There's a great small press thing going up in the Midwest. So, yeah.
Although we saw similar things when underground comics were the hot thing in the 60s. So are underground comics still part of this whole mix?
I think part of the underground aesthetic mutated into what you might call a kind of ground-level alternative. And that, I think, informs the ideas of people like Chris Ware and Art Spiegelman and Joe Sacco. Maybe, ultimately, even people like Marjane Satrapi, who comes partially out of a European tradition, though she's from Iran. And the Europeans were very much influenced by the American undergrounds.
Scott McCloud's latest book, Making Comics, is in comic book form, but there's also a lot of text things where you just didn't feel that you wanted to illustrate it or that didn't lend themselves to pictures?
Well, you know, every idea that I deliver in a panel is like Pandora's box, and it opens up so many other ideas. And sometimes I just need to just spew a little bit about some of the other implications. But I don't want to get too off the main road. And so this one has a very extensive notes section where I allow myself to pontificate, if necessary, for six paragraphs about this or that little detour that I find interesting and I hope others will, but I didn't want to slow down the rhythm of an individual sequence.
Making Comics, Storytelling Secrets of Comics, Manga, and Graphic Novels is being published as a Harper Original, and it's coming out, in a few days?
It is coming out today.
Oh. And I want to thank you, Scott McLeod, for being on our show today.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.